Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's lecture, the beginning of our first weekend after our first weekend at Einstein Fest. I see a lot of familiar faces. We had a wonderful opening weekend, lectures, performances, exhibitions. I hope you've had a chance to see the exhibitions out in the atrium and in the library. If you have not, they are open tonight until 9 o'clock, so you're welcome to stick around and visit our exhibitions. We had over 4,000 people come through the Institute on our first weekend, so we're off to a great start and look forward to seeing you many times between tonight and October 23rd. As well, I should also... Are we on there? Better now? Aha. What was I going to mention? I was going to mention that as well, you are welcome to have dinner in the Black Hole Bistro before any of our lectures or any of our events. Black Hole Bistro is on the fourth floor here in Perimeter Institute, so if you're coming to other lectures, please take advantage of our wonderful bistro. As well, after all our events, we always get together in the Black Hole, so tonight, following the lecture, please come join us upstairs. You take the elevator from the atrium, and eventually it does arrive. Be patient, and please join us on the fourth floor in the Black Hole Bistro. It'd be very nice to see you up there. I'm very, very delighted tonight to welcome Sonu Shamdasani as our lecturer. Sonu Shamdasani has researched, taught, and written extensively on the history of psychology and psychiatry. He is a research associate at the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine at University College London, and as well, he's a distinguished consulting faculty member at Saybrook Graduate School in San Francisco. He is the co-founder of the Philemon Foundation, dedicated to the very ambitious project of publishing the complete works of Jung. He is the author of three books, including the first volume of an intellectual history of Jung, entitled Jung and the Making of Modern Psychology, The Dream of a Science. He has written over 50 articles on the history of psychology, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and psychotherapy. And in the coming year, he has a new book that will appear, The Freud Report, An Inquiry into the History of Psychoanalysis. Please join me in welcoming Sonu Shamdasani.
Can you hear me? Okay. I would first like to thank the Perimeter Institute for inviting me and for their hospitality during my stay. The subject tonight is psychology, and as you will hear, there could be nothing further from Einstein's miracle year than the chaos that was rapidly engulfing the field of psychology. At the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, many individuals looked to the formation of a new science of psychology as heralding nothing less than the completion of the scientific revolution. Many figures in various disciplines began to style themselves and call themselves psychologists and claimed that this new discipline would lead to the reformulation of the humanities, of religion, of customs, of social habits, and indeed of science itself. The notion was that up till now, the last chapter of the scientific revolution remained to be fulfilled, namely to turn science back on the maker of science, psychology. Embedded within this notion was the distinction between two types of knowledge. Two types of knowledge about human beings. The first was the scientific knowledge which psychology aspired to, and the second was, how should we say, all the rest, namely any other type of conception of what it means to live, be it in philosophy, literature, theology, moral customs of any sort. And so what the knowledge that psychology aspired to was something equivalent to what was seen in the hard sciences. So they imagined that they would find their own periodic tables, their own laws, which would lead to new determinations of what motivated human activity. So psychology was seen as constituting the new basic discipline, grounding all other disciplines. And this took the form initially of an emulation or a simulation of science. They imagined that their new discipline would function exactly as the hard sciences had functioned. But pretty soon it became clear that whilst many psychologists shared the assumption that psychology should be one basic discipline as they imagined something such as physics, they all had rival competing agendas as to how this should be done. And there seemed to be an ever-increasing disagreement as to what course they should take. So psychologists attempted not only to differentiate their new knowledge, their new discipline, from other disciplines, but also amongst themselves, from other competing agendas to the one true psychology. And these matters were encapsulated in the Congress I'll be referring to throughout my talk, namely Congress for Experimental Psychology, which took place in Rome with about 400 people in attendance. What I'd like to do now is to focus specifically on one year in the biography of this would-be science, namely 1905, and I intend only to cite or specifically refer to works published within that year. So what I'd like to give is, you could say, it's a tasting menu of the various options that were taking place within psychology in a largely European and American context. I'd like to first begin with starting off in France. In France at this time, the rising star in psychology was Pierre Janet. Janet had initially trained in philosophy and subsequently took a medical degree as well. He initially taught in the somewhat provincial area of Le Havre and commenced there studying hypnosis and suggestion. His initial researches were focused on telepathic hypnotism, i.e., was it possible to hypnotize someone at a distance? And these researches concerning the possibility of doing this and the role of mental influence attracted some of the leading scientific minds of the time. And many people came to visit Janet to sort of visit him to doing his experiments. These experiments brought the attention of Jean-Martin Charcot, leading French neurologist, and Janet began writing a series of landmark articles in the 1880s. Culminating in a work in 1889 titled Psychological Automatism. In 1893, he published his medical dissertation, The Mental State of Hysterics. And that year, Charcot opened a psychological laboratory at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, which he gave to Charcot, to Janet to direct. 1902, Janet succeeded Theodore Ribot in the Collège de France, which is the most prestigious academic institution in France. In 1905, Janet published an article entitled Mental Pathology, and in this article he attempted to differentiate what was specific to French psychology. He claimed that the specific cast of psychology in France was its focus on abnormal pathological psychology, and that in France there didn't exist a bifurcation between the study of the normal and pathological as existed in other countries. The French, he said, had, quote, endeavored to throw light upon psychiatry by a study of normal psychology and to regard mental diseases as experiments which have been cunningly devised by nature to show us such suppressions and modifications of functions as the experimental method demands. Thus, Janet was claiming in France, they attempted to apply what was gleaned from normal psychology to the study of the pathological, and the pathological was seen as a natural experiment. Therefore, one could sort of have mutual reciprocation, mutual understanding between the two. Janet claimed that the failure of the old metaphysical psychology was that it confined itself to the study of normal man, and such a study tended to be static. Such phenomena as crucial to our everyday life, such as fatigue, found no mention within the manuals of the old psychology. Likewise to phenomena such as sleep, dreams, emotions. So for Janet, the new pathological psychology in France had rehabilitated these phenomena and giving them their proper due. And this had made psychology more dynamic and closer to reality. In his paper at the Rome Congress in 1905, Janet spoke on what he called the oscillations of the mental level. The concept of the mental level was quite critical in Janet's psychology. He claimed that each of us had a hierarchy of mental functions. Each function was characterized by what he called a level of psychological tension, the superior functions having the highest level. These superior functions were the most hardest to perform and hence the first affected by psychological difficulties, which led one to revert to inferior levels of mental functioning. Thus, for Janet, he argued that the task confronting psychology was further knowledge of these mental functions, these mental levels, and the oscillations between them. Could one find physical or moral agents that could act upon these? And this would do great service to mental therapeutics. Janet's great rival in France was Alfred Binet. Alfred Binet initially studied law, which he gave up in 1878 to study with Charcot at the Salpêtrière. After working there for a number of years, he took a position in 1891 at a newly formed laboratory for physiological psychology at the Sorbonne, and he became a director there and remained there to his death. In 1904, Binet had been commissioned by the Minister for Public Education to develop techniques for identifying children whose difficulties in school suggested the need for special education. So in trying to find practical means to identify this, Binet came up with the idea of subjecting these students to a series of short tasks and to see how well they performed. He argued that by doing so, one could define the mental age of a child. The mental age he defined as the youngest age where a child of normal intelligence should be able to complete a given task. Thus, his aims were purely pragmatic. He didn't think that there was any such thing such as intelligence, but the number, the mental age, was simply an average of the child's performances on various tasks. This intellectual determination of the intellectual level enabled backward or retarded children who required special education to be quickly identified. As he stated, quote, "We simply wanted to show that it is possible to record in a precise, truly scientific manner the mental level of an intelligence, to compare this level to the normal level, and consequently to conclude by how many years a child is behind." This concept of intelligence and intelligence testing was to have massive fates, as many of you are familiar with, in the 20th century. It's becoming one of the most hotly contested areas within psychology. Debates as to whether such a thing as intelligence exists, whether there is racial or sexual differences, whether intelligence is inherited or socially determined, have continued right up to this time. But it sort of begins with these tests of Binet. I'd like now to shift to Germany, where the main emphasis at this time was on systematic introspection. The main figure in psychology in Germany was Wilhelm Wundt. Wundt had studied medicine initially at the University of Heidelberg, where he became a lecturer in physiology. In 1873-4, he published his Principles of Physiological Psychology, his attempt to found scientific psychology. His work had a major impact. Whilst the first laboratory for experimental psychology had been founded in 1874 by William James at Harvard, it was Wundt's opening of his laboratory in Leipzig in 1879, which came to be seen as the canonical defining moment in the new experimental psychology. And many students flocked to study with Wundt to learn the new techniques of this new science of psychology, and took their dissertations there. Vroom's methods there are indicated by this phrase, physiological psychology. Physiological psychology was simply initially an extension of physiology, and he carried over both his training in the methods and techniques of the physiological lab. Thus, it was the institutional form of Vroom's psychology, as opposed necessarily to his own psychology, which had a massive impact. For Vroom, it was the adoption of experimentation that decisively segregated this new empirical psychology from the previous metaphysical psychology. He argued only with experimentation could psychical processes be stopped, started, and varied at will. The consequence of this was that it limited what could be studied, and he argued that the higher mental functions, such as thinking or feeling, were simply outside of the purview of experimental psychology, because they were too inconstant in subject to variation. However, this didn't mean that they fell out of this new science altogether, because he claimed that there was a special separate branch of psychology called ethnopsychology, which could study languages, mythological ideas, customs, and history. In 1905, Vroom inaugurated a new publication called Psychological Studies. It was a journal which replaced his previous philosophical studies. He argued that at the present time in psychology, there was a great tendency towards the practical exploitation of psychological experimental work, and he argued that this should be combated. So the whole aim of psychological studies for Vroom was purely theoretical knowledge of psychology. And at this time, he argued that this journal was simply to be limited to the results of people working at his laboratory in Leipzig. In experimental psychology, people began to cluster under various schools and various labs. The main rivals, or one of the main rivals for Wundt, was in Würzburg under Oswald Kulpe. In 1905, Narcisse Asch, this is also Wundt with his students in Leipzig. This is Narcisse Asch, who was a student of Oswald Kulpe, who was a representative of what came to be known as the Würzburg School. They attempted to overcome Wundt's strictures on the limitation of experimentation in psychology and subject thought to experimental study. So for them, in 1905, the big news was the experimental study of thought. Asch published his work on the activity of will and thinking. In this work, he argued that the results of the psychology of inner experience only had value when they gave rise to experimental formulations. When experimental treatment was not possible, we could have no knowledge at all. Due to the difficulties of looking at one's own psychological processes, it was important that psychologists themselves form the test persons for experimental work. And he argued, especially with beginners, there was a danger towards fantastic representations of experience, which only training and constant control could counteract. Thus, these new psychologists had to train themselves in the art of psychological experimentation. Asch's work concentrated on reaction time experiments and hypnotic experiments, and he attempted to experimentally study the will. He argued these experiments showed that thinking was determined not only by association and perseveration, as other psychologists had argued, but there also existed what he called determining tendencies, or, in other words, awarenesses. Now, pretty soon, this organization of experimental psychology into separate camps gathered around specific labs led to a quite vicious conflict between the two, because the Würzburg School came to posit the existence of what came to be known as imageless thought, whereas other psychologists later claimed, using experimental introspective techniques, that they could find no such thing. So the variation between the results of these various schools seem to discredit each other. Now turn to the United States. A number of figures went out to Leipzig to study under Wundt, and one such was Edward Titchener, who was initially American, English, and a graduate from Oxford. He did his PhD under Wundt, and he translated Wundt's work into English. And Titchener was responsible for the importation of this new German experimental psychology into the United States. He became head of the new psychological laboratory in Cornell, and he became a professor there in 1910. In 1905, Titchener's work was entitled Experimental Psychology, which was a work for students. What he attempted here was to codify the new experiments. I quote, "I've selected a number of classical experiments of experimental psychology. I've tried to present them in such a way that their performance shall have a real disciplinary value for the undergraduate student." We see here an interesting sort of shift take place, which is the shift from the use of psychologists as the test persons of psychology to undergraduate and graduate students, which later became the, you could say, the one of the defining traits of experimental psychology in the United States. They had a vast, willing sector of free students, free clients that they didn't have to pay. Titchener also published an essay in the same year entitled The Problems of Experimental Psychology. And in this, he noted that, quote, "In spite of the enormous increase in our psychological knowledge within the last few decades, we are still very far from any complete or rounded science of psychology." For Titchener, the aim of psychological experiments was the introspective acquaintance with the processes and formations in a given consciousness, i.e. it was a purely individual science. He argued that the outstanding problems confronting psychology was, one, the question of affect. What were affects? And second, and most of all, the problem of consciousness. Titchener provided the following characterization of the psychologist. Psychologist was, he said, I quote, "A man keenly interested in mind, with no purpose beyond mind. A man enamored of introspection. A man to whom the most fascinating thing in the universe is human consciousness. A man to whom successful analysis of an unresolved mental complex is as the discovery of a new genus to the zoologist or a new river to the explorer. A man who lives in direct companionship with his mental processes as the naturalist lives with the creatures that are ordinarily shunned or ignored. A man to whom the facts and laws of mind are, if I may so put it, the most real things that the world can show." It's quite an idealistic conception. The man who exists for the mind alone and seems to have no other existence. The others he dismissingly referred to as the philosophers. In the same year, professor of education and philosophy, Edward Franklin Buchner, wrote an article entitled Psychological Progress in 1905, focusing specifically on the American scene. And he highlighted two features. First, the continued effort to develop a more satisfactory relational theory of consciousness, referring specifically to pragmatism and the work of William James, which I'll come to in a moment. And second, the tendency to do, particularly in experimental matters, a small piece of work thoroughly and exhaustively, and greater criticism of earlier studies. This phenomenon of the particularism and increasing minutiae of psychological research was to become one of its defining traits in the next decades to come. In the United States at the same time, there was also importation of the new method of pathological abnormal psychology from France. Uh, And one of the main figures involved with this was Morton Prince, also a medical doctor in the Boston area. In 1905, Prince published a work entitled The Dissociation of a Personality, which instantly became a bestseller. It was the study of a woman called Christine Beecham, who, in addition to what he called her real original self, could become one of three other personalities. Prince subjected her to hypnosis and automatic writing and crystal gazing. These were legitimate techniques in psychology at this time. In terms of crystal gazing, the aim was to get a subject to hallucinate in an experimental situation. The idea being that their visions, what they saw, would be revelatory of hidden memories. Under hypnosis, Christine Beecham became what he called personality B2. B1 knew nothing of the other personalities. B2 knew of B1, B3 knew of B1 and B2. And Prince's work, like a detective novel or a murder investigation, becomes one of hunting down which is the real Miss Beecham. Ultimately, this became possible through actually killing off one of the personalities and uniting the other two. Prince also published in the same year a work entitled Problems of Abnormal Psychology. And he argued that, following Janet, that the main problems confronting psychology was the study of dissociation, the disunity of the mind. Under certain abnormal or induced conditions, he argued, there were a certain number of elementary conscious states whose existence we are ignorant, which nevertheless coexist with the habitual waking consciousness, which we term ourselves or our own personality. So the attempt was, he argued, to study these states in which consciousness became dissociated. The type of example that we'd use at this time is if you try to read something in which, while someone else is reading something to you, you find that your consciousness alternates between the two. It's very hard to be fixed on two trains of thought at the same time. This, at a very simple level, this tendency to dissociate, they argued that in severe cases, could become pathological. One can have two separate streams of consciousness that would be quite unaware of each other and that could alternate. This became, you could say, the center point of the multiple personality movement. Another work, titled quite simply Multiple Personality, was published by Boris Sidis and Goodhart. This work was based on the case of the Reverend Thomas Carson Hanna, who fell out of his carriage and was no longer himself. Under hypnosis, they brought to light memories, and their task was attempting to synthesize these two personalities into one. So the notion was that personality could, under severe stress or trauma, become split, and the therapeutic task was to find ways of healing and reorganizing the split. Moreover, they argued that this splitting or dissociation of consciousness itself enabled one insight into the formation of the mind, to how personality became organized in the first place. So this was an application of Janet's notion that when you watch the mind in disorder, you actually can use it as a natural experiment to see how the mind actually functions. Come now to William James. William James had studied medicine at Harvard and was appointed a lecturer there in physiology in 1872. His interests became rapidly orientated towards psychology, and he published his work, Principles of Psychology, in 1890, only about 10 years overdue to the publishers. In keeping with the general tendency of psychologists, in this work, James ventured to set aside metaphysical questions as outside the purview of the new positivistic science. However, what differentiated him from other psychologists was he took up these questions with a vengeance rather than abandoning them. Until recently, it's become a commonplace in James scholarship that after 1890, he progressively abandoned psychology for philosophy. But as my colleague Eugene Taylor has shown, that far from abandoning psychology, what James had attempted to do was to develop a critique of the metaphysical assumptions of the new psychology and to pave the way for the development of psychology through developing a new metaphysics of radical empiricism. And it was upon this subject of radical empiricism that James ventured to speak upon at the last minute of the Rome Congress in 1905. He hadn't actually been due to speak, but they had invited many people who actually were only provisional and never showed up. James's talk there, delivered in French, was on the notion of consciousness. In this talk, he came to express the doubts that he'd come to have about the very notion of consciousness. He argued that psychology had often defined itself as a science of consciousness. Indeed, James himself had done so several decades earlier. And within this, he argued, there was the fundamental dualism that was a defining trait of all psychologies, namely a distinction between subject and object. There was a fundamental dualism between ideas and things seen as utterly distinct. Now, it was precisely this distinction that James invited his audience in Rome to reconsider. He asked them to look at the walls of the room, and it's a bit dark in here, so I don't know at least from here whether one can manage to do that. And he argued that could one actually distinguish between the psychical and the physical? Were these absolutely heterogeneous? For James, he claimed that our sensations weren't small duplicates of things. They were the things themselves. Thought and actuality, he argued, were made up of the same stuff, which he called experience in general. He used the example of his hat. He argued, if I think of my hat, which I left in the vestibule, where is the discontinuity between the hat thought about and the real hat? My mind is occupied with a real absent hat. If it is on the table, it determines the movement of my hand. Likewise, the conceived hat determines my steps. He argued that there was an imperceptible shift from one to the other, where there was no real distinction that could be clearly drawn between the two. And he argued that this was exemplary of a whole host of other phenomena of our experience. We couldn't determine whether they're purely psychic or physical, and the prime example being that of our bodies themselves. Thus, he came to the conclusion that consciousness was simply a chimera that didn't exist. These distinctions, such as subject and object, had a practical significance, but had no ontological basis. They weren't part of the fundamental building blocks of which our world was conceived of. So what was James proposing was a radical dismantling of the notion of consciousness of the subject-object distinction and the basis upon which everyone else basically had attempted to construct a new psychology. And I would like to switch now to developments in Switzerland. And this is Auguste Forel. Forel initially qualified in medicine in Zurich, and he pursued his interest in the natural sciences and entomology and published a work on the insects of Switzerland. In Munich, he worked on brain anatomy, and his work there was pivotal in the formulation of a theory of the neuron. In 1879, he was appointed professor of psychiatry at the University of Zurich and director of the Burgholzli Asylum. And whilst there, he attempted to introduce the practice of hypnosis and suggestion from France. Forel conceived of his wide-ranging interests in brain anatomy to entomology to psychiatry and social reform as essentially related, and claimed it was from ants, in fact, that he learned the value of industry and community. He became active in the anti-temperance movement and left the Burgholzli because he felt that the main causes of social disorder were to be found in factors such as alcoholism, that they had to be combated in society. In 1905, he published a work called The Sexual Question, which became an instant bestseller. In fact, the first edition sold out in 14 days. It was a big book, about 500-600 pages, and was a study of the sexual question in all its aspects, scientific, ethnological, pathological, and social, and dealt with issues such as social reform, contraception, the emancipation of women, pornography, alcohol, state interference, and eugenics. So it's a huge, vast ranging work, which indicates the range of issues within what was known as sexology or sexual science, which was a vast discipline at that time. After Forel left the Burke Halsey, his position was taken up by one of his former students, Eugen Bleuler. In contrast to Forel, Bleuler could speak the local dialect and could communicate much better with his patients. During this time, Bleuler was in the process of transforming Emil Kraepelin's diagnostic category of dementia praecox into the modern notion of schizophrenia. And that's Kraepelin. I won't say much about Kraepelin, as he didn't publish much of significance in 1905. Go back to Bleuler. And it was also at this time that Bleuler introduced the practice of psychoanalysis into Burke Holstein and began corresponding with Freud. In Freud's interpretation of dreams, Freud claimed that the way to become to practice psychoanalysis was to study one's own dreams. And so Bleuler wrote to Freud indicating that he would like some instruction in interpreting his dreams, upon which he'd had difficulty. The advent of the interest in psychoanalysis in the Burke Halsey put psychoanalysis on the international map. Freud at this point was simply viewed as a crank neurologist with somewhat dubious ideas. Bleuler indicated to Freud that he'd been long convinced that he had problems with his bowel movements, and this was somehow connected with sexuality. So all Freud had to do was somehow convince Bleuler of the truth of his interpretations and hope for some alleviation in his bowel movements. Perhaps the world of German language psychiatry would be his. Also working under Bleuler was Carl Gustav Jung. This year he published a work on the study of reaction times in the association experiments. What Jung was attempting to do was to fuse the German experimental tradition with that of the French psychology of the subconscious. Thus, Jung and his co-worker Franz Rücklin were arguing that in the association experiments in which a subject was given, read a list of 100 words and asked to react, this was one of the hallmarks of which Wundt had used to measure reaction times in Leipzig. What Jung and Rücklin focused on was failures to react. They argued that these failures to react, times when a certain word was read and subject took, say, 5 or 10 seconds instead of one to respond, were indicators of what they called an emotionally stressed complex. Further investigation into these words would reveal factors of critical emotional significance to these subjects. So they argued that this area of the French psychology of the unconscious, of the subconscious, of dissociation, could thus be studied in an experimental manner. In England, also, the study of sexology was booming, and Havelock Ellis published the fourth volume of his studies in the psychology of sex, which was a study of the sexual selection in man and in the evolutionary form. Meanwhile, in Austria, Freud published his three essays on sexuality. And as I've just given some brief indication, the field of sexology was a burgeoning field with a great deal of works being published. And as I said, the work which was the bestseller that year was Forel's The Sexual Question. As the Swiss historian of psychiatry, long-term resident in Montreal, Henri Ellenberger, noted, there had been a flood of literature on sexual psychology and pathology. There's hardly anything in the three essays that had not been anticipated in one way or another. for its three essays focused on three linked subjects. The first was taken with a classification of sexual deviations as to the object and aim of the sexual drive. The second essay was concerned with the phases of infantile sexuality, and the third with the transformations of puberty. So the main topics of this were these essays were on the concept of the libido, the primary sexual drive, the choice of love objects, and sexual symbolism in the manner in which sexual libido became transformed into other aims. I'd like now to consider some further general conceptions of the state of psychology, which psychologists made in 1905. This is Charles Richet, a Parisian psychologist and physiologist and psychical researcher. Richet played an important role in the 1870s and 1880s in rehabilitating the study of hypnosis in science in France. He was later to win the Nobel Prize in 1913 as a physiologist for his work on anaphylaxis, namely the manner in which the immune system reacts adversely to an antigen to which it has been previously sensitized. In 1905, in his paper at the Rome Congress, Richet spoke on the future of psychology. He began by inviting his audience to reflect back on the first Congress of Physiological Psychology in 1889. I quote, "Our ardent desire had been to reunite in a unique bundle the apparently most disparate branches of psychology, to reconcile the tendencies of the sociologists, of the doctors, the occultists, who interested themselves in diverse aspects of the study of the human soul. It seems to me, viewing this gathering, the fusion of all psychologists is something accomplished." Now, Richet claimed that he didn't think that there was much to be done on the side of psychological side of the social sciences, on aesthetics or medical psychology. He thought, quite honestly, that people had really got as far as they would get, more or less. The two big areas where he thought where the future of psychology resided was the resolution of the mind-body problem and what he called metapsychics, his word for psychical research, or as it later became known, parapsychology, which was at that time still seen as a major part of experimental psychology. Another view as to the state of psychology was also given at this Congress by Theodor Lips, German psychologist, and he focused on the study of consciousness. He argued that, and he warned that if one applied foreign concepts to the facts of consciousness, it simply vitiated the whole field. All other sciences had occupied themselves with objects distinct from the ego, but the aim of psychology was to study the ego itself. Psychology, thus he reiterated and reaffirmed, was the study of the science of consciousness. In England, William McDougall published a work entitled Physiological Psychology in 1905. After studying medicine, he became interested in psychology, being inspired by a reading of William James's Principles of Psychology, and became a reader in mental philosophy at Oxford. He was one of the most, probably the most widely known psychologist in England, and later emigrated to the USA. And he provided this definition of psychology. Quote, "Psychology may be best and most comprehensively defined as the positive science of the conduct of living creatures. Must understand the word conduct in the widest possible sense as denoting the sum of activities by which any creature maintains its relation to other creatures and with the world of physical things. Psychology is more commonly defined as the science of mind or the science of mental or psychical processes of consciousness or of individual experience. Such definitions are ambiguous and without further elaboration are not sufficiently comprehensive." So we find a massive shift. He's saying you can't define psychology as a science of mind or of consciousness. It is of conduct, or as some later figures would call of behavior, of how we act. That is what we have to study. Further statements were made in Germany by Hermann Ebbinghaus. Ebbinghaus had obtained a PhD in philosophy in 1873, and his work of 1885 on memory was a landmark in experimental psychology. In this work, Ebbinghaus had embarked upon the experimental study of memory in himself and memorizing lists and looking at his recollection. And so it sort of formed a template for memory studies. Ebbinghaus had established several laboratories for experimental psychology in Germany. In 1905, he published a work entitled The Essentials of Psychology. He argued, again, completely differently to William McDougall, that psychology is the science of contents and processes of mental life, or as one can also say, the science of states of consciousness and conscious processes. He argued that psychology had to do with objects of the inner world, contrast to physics, in which the wider sense is the science of objects of the spatial and material outer world. One here finds the metaphorical transfer of spatial concepts to the mind, the notion that there exists such a thing such as the inner world, that psychology almost had to find something analogous to talk about in the manner in which other scientists talked of external objects. He argued that psychology was not concerned with the individual experience of individuals, but with the common experiences of classes of individuals. And it dealt with general characteristics and conformity to laws, just as physics or chemistry. The only difference was that it dealt with the world of the invisible, imperceptible and non-spatial. Again, one is dealing here with how psychologists are imagining these scientists to function, not actually with what is taking place in those sciences at this time. In comparison with other natural sciences, Ebbinghaus claimed that psychology was in a backward condition. And the reasons for this, he argued, were that psychic phenomena were exceptionally more complicated, inconstant, and deceptive than physical phenomena, therefore more difficult to observe and to reduce to something relatively simple. Furthermore, he argued that with many of its problems, psychology stands too close to the strong and important interests of people not to become harmed through struggle with them. Thus, psychology, as it were, shared its subject with its audience, and it had to struggle to prize its subject away from its audience. He noted that the relative immaturity of psychology was evidenced by the fact that there was continual conflict over nearly all of its general questions. Further remarks upon the status of psychology were made in America by James McKean Cattell. Cattell was one of the first professors of psychology in the United States. And he'd worked as Wundt's assistant in Leipzig. And his focus was on the experimental study of intelligence. He was head of psychology at Columbia University and the first president of the American Psychological Association. His later public opposition to American involvement in World War I, together with his opposition to the draft, led to his dismissal from Columbia, which led to the establishment of tenure at many universities as a means of protecting academics with unpopular views. I mentioned at the outset that I was restricting myself to discussing works published in 1905. I made one exception here, which was a piece by Cattell published on the conception and methods of psychology in December 1904. I thought, well, you know, 1 month was close enough. People probably read it in January and was too busy over December to get to it. And in this piece, Cattell embarked upon quite a radically different shift in terms of the definitions of psychology. As we've seen, most of these definitions had focused on what were the grounding problems of psychology. Was it the study of consciousness? How could this be studied? Was it the study of behavior, of conduct, and so forth? And attempted to sort of form a closed, determined theoretical grasp of fundamental aspects of the object of psychology and hence its methods. Now, Cattell began by noting that psychology quote, has never had a well-defined territory. As states of consciousness appear to be less stable and definite than the objects of the material world, so the science of psychology is more shifting in its contents than any physical science. But for Cattell, unlike others, this was not a factor to be complained about. And he stated, quote, I can only say that psychology is what the psychologist is interested in qua psychologist. Therefore, psychology could become anything that the psychologist wanted to study as a psychologist. Pretty wide definition. And he went on to say, we not only have psychologists who are philosophers, but psychologists who are also physiologists, anatomists, pathologists, zoologists, anthropologists, philologists, sociologists, physicists, or mathematicians. Again, one sees here that they're still maintained with this grounding ambition that psychology will, in a way, supersede all of these disciplines, or is still capable of grasping something that none of these disciplines can grasp in their own terms. Psychology, again, shared its subject with its audience. Quote, it seems quite obvious that such knowledge as each of us has of his own perceptions, mental processes and motor responses and of the reactions and activities of others being continually used more continually than any other knowledge whatever. Therefore, he's arguing that all of us use some form of knowledge of both how we understand ourselves and how we understand others. This is, you could say, psychology in a nascent form. It was like the task of psychologists to refine this knowledge. I quote, all of our systems of education, our churches, our legal systems, our governments, and the rest are applied psychology. Maybe at present pseudoscience in the sense that we've drawn conclusions without adequate knowledge, but it's nonetheless the best we can do in the way of the application of systematized knowledge to the control of human nature. This then was his conception of what psychology was. Form of systematized knowledge used to control and ultimately to predict human behavior. And thus he had great still ambitions for the task of this applied psychology. Quote, it's not necessary for a man to be either a psychologist or a fool at 40. He may, for example, be both. But surely it is possible to discover whether or not it is desirable to feed a baby every time it cries, to whip a boy when he disobeys, to put a man in prison when he breaks the law. If each man were given the work he is most competent to do and were prepared for his work in the best way, the work of the world, all the way from the highest manifestations of genius, the humblest daily labor would be more than doubled. I see no reason why the application of systematized knowledge to the control of human nature may not result in the course of the present century to accomplish results commensurate with the 19th century applications of physical science to the material world. Thus, it was a great hope for the complete transformation of society through this new applied psychology. So he argued that within the mode in which the modern world was developing, there would be a great need for this systematized knowledge of human behavior. It was precisely to this need that the psychologist, as scientist, should make themselves available. And he argued, in the end, there will not only be a science, but also a profession of psychology. Thus, we see a very critical shift. The failure to resolve its basic, fundamental, or foundational questions did not impede the growth of psychology as a science or a discipline. Far from it. It actually enabled the growth of psychology, because psychology could become anything one wanted it to do. Psychologists could study anything and call it psychology, and whatever needs one had of a psychologist qua expert, there would be a psychologist willing to provide it. And again, legitimated by academic prestige and the aura of a new science. Other reflections were also presented by Alfred Binet, who I mentioned earlier, for studies of intelligence. In 1905, he published a work entitled The Soul and the Body. And in this work, he was attempting to deal with the mind-body problem. He argued that to define the mind is at the same time to define psychology. So in attempting to resolve the mind-body problem, he was also providing a general definition of psychology. And
familiar with many of these debates, which I've mentioned in passing, Binet argued that there were so many definitions of psychology that the time had come to provide a veritable typology of different types of definitions of psychology. And there were seven main types of definition. Definitions by substance, definition by enumeration, definition by method, definition by degree of certainty, definition by content, definition by point of view, and finally, definitions by the peculiar nature of mental laws. He argued that the very variety of definitions pointed to their insufficiency, and he provided his own definition. Not to be outdone, quote, "Psychology studies a certain number of laws, which we term mental, in opposition to those of external nature, from which they differ, but which, properly speaking, do not deserve the qualification of mental, since they are, or at least the best known of them are, laws of images, and the images are material elements." Well, I think you can perhaps guess that this definition didn't get very far and wasn't taken up by anyone other than Binet. This general confusion was came to a head, in a way, at the Rome Congress. And Edward Buckner, whose work on review of the progress in 1905, commented as follows on this Rome Congress. "The geographical unity of time and space afforded the international speakers must not be mistaken for the inner and progressive unity of a science. As for psychologists, there was no marked agreement. Each continued to speak then, just as he had hitherto thought in his individual capacity." I mentioned earlier William James's paper at the Rome Congress, and this was his letters to his wife, Alice Howell Gibbons James, from Rome. This is his first letter. "I've skipped the inauguration solemnity at which the ministers of public instruction at 10 o'clock this a.m. received the Congress at the Capitol, and shall skip the first of the sittings of sections this afternoon at 2, in order to be fresh for a general social reception which the members indulge at 5, in order to be better acquainted with one another." James was not one for attending serial paper giving. 2 days later, he had this to say to his wife. "One day the Congress has done me up. Great confusion and endless talk in foreign languages. I shall absent myself till Sunday a.m. when I make my own speech." And with that, he departed. Thus, to conclude, we see that there is no greater contrast between Einstein's miracle year and what was happening in psychology. Nevertheless, the hopes and ambitions of psychology, the hopes and ambitions which would have been things shared by large populations in terms of these quite popular works diffused to large audiences, never materialized. And at the same time, one finds an exponential growth in precisely these types of problems that are already being frayed in 1905. If one moves the clock forward 100 years, one still finds absolutely no unanimity on any basic question. One can't point to a single incontrovertible law upon which all psychologists would agree. So that this, what one can see in the cross-section of these debates and disagreements in 1905, provides a window into what has happened in contemporary psychology in the century to come. And likewise, one finds Cattell's prediction that nevertheless psychology will fulfill a very important social function taking place. So the question is, what does this then say about this discipline of psychology? Its main problems, the problem of the mind-body relations, still remain unsolved. The problem of consciousness still remain unsolved, or whether there is, in fact, as James said, anything called consciousness, or whether it's worth one's while even attempting to study it. And these great programmatic statements still come to be issued in psychology. The relation of the mind and the body at this time becomes articulated within conceptions of the neuroscience, which is again supposed to revolutionize not only the science of psychology but all aspects of human life. So one finds simply a reinvention of the wheel unwittingly. Many of these new debates simply reiterate not only the languages and aspirations, but many of the problems which psychologists and physiologists already encountered 100 years ago. What I've attempted to do here is also to give you a window into the history of psychology, because it's, in my view, precisely the value of the history of psychology that it can help us look into the psychology-making process. If psychology still remains in mired in difficulty in attempting to encounter and study these very real questions of great moment, nevertheless, I think that light can be shed in an indirect form by studying how psychologists work to discover, attempt to study what is this activity called psychology. Can we understand in a somewhat indirect way a little bit more about ourselves by looking at this would-be science, how it came to be launched and why it never quite lived up to its aspirations, which still remain today? So, thank you.
If we could have a bit of house lights, ladies and gentlemen, we have time for a few questions. There are microphones on each side of the theater. If you'd like to put your hand up and wait for a microphone to come, we can take a few questions.
Do you think that the basic schools, the number of like schools or camps maybe that people would divide themselves into in the psychology community, has the number has increased since 100 years ago, or were they basically in place then?
It's exponentially increased. So just to add to that, the only commonality one can point to is the use of the word psychology.
Can we have applied psychology, how to make our mind powerful, progressive, and sensitive?
So could you say a bit more about that?
Hello?
Yes.
We want to use psychology, science of psychology.
Yes.
Applied psychology.
Yeah.
Suppose we want to make our mind powerful, progressive, and sensitive. How can this science help us?
There are many schools of psychology and psychotherapy available with quite sophisticated techniques for transforming one's mental capacities. So it's really a question of take your pick. The many psychologists that will provide many different ways in which one can alter one's mental functioning. And I don't mean this critically, I mean to say that these things work.
What do you think of the developments within evolutionary psychology in their attempts to unite psychology with evolutionary biology, anthropology, neuroscience, and so forth?
One sees already with some of the figures I was talking about, the big event at that time was Darwin. And the question was, how could you shift from a purely philosophical psychology to looking upon mind in nature, mind as adaptive, mind as functional? So the notion was, how could you ground the study of psychology within an evolutionary context? Thus, for instance, I mentioned Havelock Ellis's study of psychology of sex. What's interesting about that is it's purely evolutionary. It's about sexual selection, which is exactly what evolutionary psychologists talk about today. So one actually finds the same template taking place, the attempt to ground psychology in another discipline. Now, one sees now as then this problem of interdisciplinarity emerge. And if you take an example such as William James's Principles of Psychology and ask the question, what in it is out of date? And it's all the neurophysiology. And you could almost say that one thing one could say about psychology is what has failed most is any attempt to ground psychology within something else. And as it were, right on the back of another discipline. And so I think that the evolutionary psychology of today will go the way the evolutionary psychology of 100 years ago.
Do you think that psychologists over the last 100 years have actually achieved anything significant? And if you do, what do you think their most significant achievement has been?
Well, I think that they've achieved a great deal, and a great deal that is of significance, in the sense that I tried to contrast the initial aspirations of psychology to form a fundamental science, and a growing realization among psychologists of the gulf between the ideal and its realization and what was coming to pass. Now, if one suspends that initial dream that motivated this whole enterprise and say, well, nevertheless, psychology is something that is present within our societies that has transformed human life in ways that one simply can't avoid. The question is, how does one think about that? And if it's not then a science, one should not, in the way that it initially conceived itself, one should ask a different set of questions to it. So the question, for example, one could say, have psychologies helped individuals to understand themselves better? Have they helped people to live better? And the answer inevitably has to be both yes and no, depending on who you address that to, in the sense that one can no longer evaluate psychology in a global sense. One has to look at the particular developments in the social and cultural setting and ask the agents and actors themselves whether they found that of value. So that there can be to me no general dissolution of this unitary conception of the field and of the science also leads to the dissolution of evaluation. You can't simply say, you know, evaluate psychology in any simple manner.
My questions are rather trivial, but draws first-year students in droves to psychology departments?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you too well.
Louder. As I said, my questions are trivial, but what draws droves of students, first-year students, into psychology departments?
That's an interesting question. I once taught psychology at in England at A level, and there, a number of students took it because they thought it was a soft option, and were suddenly hit by a vast barrage of statistics and experimentation, and had second thoughts very quickly. But I think that just anecdotally. I think that in terms of many individuals I know, I mean, I for myself was first drawn to the study of psychology before I became interested in history. And it was a question of just these very basic human questions of, well, how do we understand one another? And can we simply by use of our own thinking learn to understand ourselves better without recourse to revelation or any other authority. So that almost the process of psychology is the blind leading the blind was something that appealed to me. And I only subsequently turned to history when it seemed to me to try to understand how psychology got into the state it had got into.
Wait for the microphone, please.
You spoke primarily of European psychology. Over the years, a movement called indigenous psychology has arisen. That is that perceptions of human nature from other cultures, in particular Asian and African cultures, have been moving into mainstream and using the methodologies of European psychology in addition to new innovative methodologies which people in Africa and Asia feel or can demonstrate probe their particular view of the world and of themselves. What do you think this indigenous movement can contribute to largely Euro-American psychology?
Well, there are several aspects of your question. I'd like to first comment on this term indigenous psychology, because what took place, again, around the period I was talking about was an expansion of the term psychology. There was a great deal of interest in the history of psychology, and it's almost to legitimate the discipline, people projected psychology backward and sideways. So they said, well, psychology hasn't just come around in the last 20 years, there always was psychology, and actually the first psychologists were Plato and Aristotle, regardless of what they said. So the notion was, it was an attempt to almost colonize other forms of human understanding and say, that was really psychology. Likewise, if one, say, goes to looks at other traditions, or the one that I sort of, it's most familiar to me, yoga is not a psychology. It's not ever conceived of as a psychology. But then certain moves became afoot to describe other forms of understanding in different cultures as psychology. And I think that's quite problematic. And I don't think that it serves a useful function. But that the second part of your question is, what, leaving aside the issue of nomenclature, leaving aside the question of naming, your question is, what is the role of what are referred to as indigenous psychologies? What contribution can they make? Well, I think that it's quite obvious that when one opens up to a diversity and polarity of views of different forms of self-understanding and regards them as legitimate and equally valid, that is critical to the possibility at a political level of enabling us to live together in terms of a recognition of plurality and difference.
We have time for one more question, if there is one.
I found it most interesting in your lecture that when defining how psychology defines itself, that each psychologist or psychological lecturer determines what psychology is for themselves, and it seems like an awful lot of double talk. What practical applications have psychology presented in the last 100 years, in your opinion?
Practical applications.
It seems like each psychologist is defining psychology based on their own personal opinions, as opposed to having a specific practical application for psychology. Is there one significant contribution that you can make note of?
Well, just to reiterate, for instance, I was mentioning Binet and the use of intelligence tests. So this is, I don't know if one wants to term it an achievement, but this is a very real phenomenon that is one can't avoid in terms of the concept of intelligence in today's society and how that affects social policy and how that came to affect even immigration policies. So, or I was talking about Janet, Morton Prince, and Boris Sidis in terms of attempting to develop a pathological psychology in relation to therapeutics. This had a vast significant effect on the development of psychotherapy. So at every stage, you're quite right to say that they're defining psychology in their own ways, which begins to look like an orchestra full of soloists who refuse to talk to one another or listen to one another. Nevertheless, they each are going off and not only forming schools, but having very real effects on how individuals live their lives, which is why it needs to be thought about and in sort of to look at how is one to evaluate the presence of the social phenomena in one's life and how does one to come to terms with that.
So I think we'll end the formal part of this evening. The informal part can continue, as I said before, in the Black Hole Bistro. Hope you'll join us up there, and I'd like to ask for another round of applause and thank you very much to so many.
Thank you.